one great thing for me about living so much of my life in India is the great appreciation for those kind of microphone moments that end up being the sort of the sweetness of the event. If things just went so smoothly, we would get all professional and also gives a chance for that extension, manifestation of love in the form of Echan. And I don't know the name of the other one.
Eitan?
Eitan. When I was a little girl, they started to organize soccer. Do you call it soccer or football here? Football. I'm going to call it soccer. Okay. And so I started to play when I was around 6 or 7. And I was so shy that I had gotten, like, rejected from the school. I was too shy to get into the kindergarten. And when I started to play soccer, it changed. So that importance of the team, as well as the play. And we were called the Hurricanes because there had just been a big hurricane that had destroyed half of Florida. And so that was the strong name for this team, who lost every single game. Not only the first season, the second season, third season. I don't know how many seasons we lost. But not just, I'm not exaggerating. And also the first year, I don't think we scored even one goal. So it wasn't just losing, it was 5-0, 13-0. This is soccer, not basketball. Soccer. And I didn't realize until much later why it was that after some time, we started to be really good, and we started to win every game. And again, not exaggerating, every game. And then it started to be we were winning 13-1, then 13-0. Only later I found out it was just simply a change of coach. The coaches changed from the just volunteer parents that didn't actually play soccer to someone who played soccer and knew how to play, knew the rules of the game. But in a way, it was kind of a good feeling that it was as if by losing all that, those games, somehow we learned and we got good. Someone that I know is writing a book, and it's very challenging for her to face the pages that she needs to write, the research that she needs to do, and so on. And so she started seeing someone who could help coach her. Not a writer, but someone who could coach her with her internal places of giving up and courage and facing the page. And this was a therapist, not any other title than that. Very good one. And she said, you know, Susan, when you were little, you didn't have, your parents weren't a coach or your cheerleader or your fan. You didn't have a coach or a cheerleader or a fan. You just did that for yourself. You didn't have that. So now we have the chance to grow our own coach, cheerleader, fan. This morning I was delighted to hear that someone actually listened to something that I said a few years ago, that it dropped in and came through into his life. what I said was, I love you. I didn't really know him. And I remember feeling like, why would I say that to him? But it stayed with him on the long bus ride from that South Indian town to wherever he was going. And it even started to rub up against something in him that felt a little bit uncomfortable. And he tried to put that away. That slight unease. So we're on a deep rest retreat, but deep resting into ourselves in a way that actually allows deep unease sometimes to surface. So not to think that's something wrong when that happens. And he thought, oh yeah, so I should, the way he tried to put it away, this being told, I love you by someone, he had only been on one retreat. It was a weird thing to say to him on my part. But it was rubbing up against something inside him, and his way of trying to put that unease away was to say to himself, oh, I'll kind of somehow use that as a teaching moment in my own teaching. And then he remembered something that he had been reading about how people, when they have an unease in the soul, in the language of that teaching, they tend to eat. We tend to eat. We eat, and then we don't birth, as the teaching was, we don't birth that soul movement. And so he tried to put away this unease that was happening in him on this long bus ride in South India by saying, oh, I'll use that and I'll teach it to someone. But it didn't go away. Then he reached for the crackers and he remembered, ah, what's happening? And he just gave space for it, sitting on the bus. Bum, bum, bum. Maybe the movement of the bus helped the birth. And he was able to feel by that just simple and also kind of silly moment that someone that he doesn't know said, I love you. It touched something. And it helped him fall into a place where he just felt loved. He simply felt loved. That could be like finding, the way he put it was, not only do we work with the inner child, but we grow the inner parent. So we can call it a parent or a coach or whatever. So, we do want to find that coach that will give us good suggestions, that knows maybe the game. And especially in spiritual game, in spiritual playfulness, we want to find both inner and outer support, guidance, suggestions that know how to play the game, but they also know that it is a game. Because it would be so easy to just come into meditation now and get really good at winning. And that would be a terrible loss. It could have been with the first coaches, or it could have been with the second coach. I don't remember. It was somewhere in the middle of my time playing. And I always played defense. I was always fullback. I had no interest in being in the front and making a goal. And I was good, apparently, at being a fullback. And I loved it, and we had fun together, and so I was really into it. And so when the ball would come with someone near me, I would almost always get it away from them. I would just dive in, and the ball would go out. And it only through playing that way, and partly it was good, that I still didn't quite know all of the more obscure, the less known rules, and just found out about them as they came up. So one time I was getting the ball away from someone, and I found myself down on the ground, still getting the ball away from someone. And all of a sudden the whistle blew. The referee blew the whistle. And so I got up and I assumed, well, the other person must, the referee must have thought the other person hurt me or something because I obviously didn't do anything wrong. So I got up and brushed myself off and was ready for our team to take the penalty kick. And then I found out that it was me, that I had gotten the penalty because it was called dangerous play. And it wasn't that I endangered anyone else. It was that I endangered myself. And I remember being on the field, like, what? in sports, you get in trouble, you get a penalty for endangering yourself. I still remember the disbelief and the kind of revelation that it's good to be, and it's important, in fact, to come to the place where we can be really wholehearted and a kind of innocence of just giving all we have to what we think is important and helpful to do. And by doing that, we can come up against where, oh, that's going too far. That's endangering yourself. And that's when then we can have the inner referee, maybe, that we find. Who lets us know that wholehearted and giving with our whole being without holding back, in general, is what's needed. But it's true, when I was down there, suddenly I found myself down and I was still kicking with both of my legs to get the ball. It was dangerous and I hadn't realized because I was so focused on the ball. And this is when, these are these moments of disbelief and where we think, but I gave everything. I did it all right. I was giving everything to get the ball out of the way. And what do you mean it's a penalty on me? What do you mean dangerous play? In our practice where we can find that something has been focusing our energy and our efforts in a way that's not quite aware enough, sensitive enough of ourselves as we are. There's something that's focused on some kind of goal. And so this is where we have the chance to refine our sensing through what resonates with us of what is the good inner suggestion, the inner parent, the inner referee, inner coach, whatever. When we have the moments of something in life stops us, or some inner stopping comes and says, yeah, you're giving wholeheartedly, totally in kind of a beautiful innocence of just getting in there and not holding back. But what are you not holding back from? There is some direction still that's now leading away from what's helpful. So I'd just like to hang out here with this contrast between wholeheartedness and when we can find ourselves going to an extreme that's not helpful. So Jay Krishnamurti, this you probably can't see, handsome, elegant Indian gentleman teacher who's no longer living. Speaking of what could be the place of thought, and especially in this case, memory. He says, of course, memory has a place at a certain level. In everyday life, we could not function at all without it. In its own field, it must be efficient, but there is a state of mind where it has very little place. A mind which is not crippled by memory has real freedom. So first we can just absorb this statement. A mind that's not crippled by memory has real freedom. So memory could be there, but the mind isn't crippled by. Do you know the word crippled? What would it be in? So I can just explain. Crippled would be like, I can't, let's find a good way to say. I think we could say burdened or weighed down. So with the mind, it could have a certain lightness. It could have a certain way that it's flexible. But because of memory, usually for most of the time, the mind is heavy because of memory. And so it can't move around lightly, and it doesn't have flexibility. It doesn't have responsiveness. So a mind not burdened by, not weighed down by memory, not cramped, not contracted by memory, has real freedom. Have you ever noticed, let's see if I can do the light and the microphone. Have you ever noticed that when you respond to something totally with all your heart, there's very little memory? It is only when you do not respond to a challenge with your whole being that there is conflict, struggle, and this brings confusion and pleasure or pain. And the struggle breeds memory. That memory is added to all the time, by other memories, and it is those memories which respond. Okay. So the important thing that we have the chance for on a deep rest retreat is a chance to have the felt difference between what's helpful and what's unhelpful. In situations where if I try to get it mentally, it's very confusing and very hard to tell the difference. In the felt sense, the contrast is possible to feel, sometimes easy to feel. So the felt difference, first of all, between the mind that is contracted and burdened, weighed down by memory. And if we think of where Krishnamurti says the memory is coming from, is when we had the brakes on and the gas on. We were driving with brakes and gas, petrol, whatever you call it here. We were accelerating and braking at the same time. We were there, but not quite there. And because of being divided in our living, because of pushing forward and holding back at the same time, there is conflict. And then because of the conflict, there's a certain kind of pleasure and pain. So then what's interesting to us is to feel into when I'm pushing forward and pulling back at the same time. Or if we could say it more accurately, not that I'm pushing forward and pulling back at the same time, but pushing forward and pulling back at the same time is happening. And sometimes that can just be, because it makes sense and it's not really my fault. Oh, it just, that's how it works. We've been trained to be pushing forward and pulling back at the same time. That's what we've been told is helpful. Push forward and pull back at the same time. And so we've gotten used to burning out. Yeah? Burning out. We've gotten used to being exhausted. We've gotten used to feeling like we're giving everything we have. But we're giving everything we have into pushing forward and pulling back. And it does take tremendous energy to push forward and pull back at the same time. And so there's all this heat as well, and we're aware of our effort. That's another important part. Our effort is easy to feel when we push forward and pull back at the same time. It's hot. It's tiring. It does take everything we have, and then we can't anymore. So we can start to feel when that's happening, what it feels like. When it's happening and we feel what it feels like, we can't always get it to stop. We can sometimes ask that to stop, but it doesn't always listen to us. But we can then have the chance to really get in our system, what does that feel like? Pushing forward, pulling back. Have you ever noticed that when you respond to something totally with all your heart, there is very little memory? It is only when you do not respond to a challenge with your whole being that there is a conflict, a struggle, and this brings confusion and pleasure or pain. And the struggle breeds memory. So the struggle breeds memory. This is also very interesting for our exploration. It's much easier to feel this kind of effort, pushing forward, pulling back. It's easier to feel. It's hot and it takes all we have and then we can't anymore. It's also easy to remember because it breeds memory. So it takes up more space in our story of our lives than the times when we actually are more total. Yeah? It's easier to feel that kind of, maybe not even effort, struggle. Maybe not even struggle. Division, that divided energy, divided. Movement or divided living. And it's very much more likely that we'll remember that, and it will take up more importance in how we think of our lives than what it actually has. And so, on the other hand, the moments where we're more totally there, so that might be because we really love doing something, we get absorbed, or whether we love or not, being in a creative mode, it can be sometimes quite difficult to be in a creative mode, but we're absorbed in that flow. We're more totally in there. Also, when we sleep. Also, when we rest. Also, when we meditate. So when we meditate, the whole idea is that the effort is less and less working against itself, pushing and pulling. And more questioning that division, not so much mentally questioning, but feeling the confusion that comes with pushing and pulling at the same time. And then, is that confusion really necessary? Does it really belong here? Is it needed? Is it helpful? Because there can be very fertile confusion. But this has a different kind of smoky heat. And we can play with here relaxing. And then we may find that we do have support when we relax out of that pushing, pulling that we're doing to get by, to survive, to win, or whatever. We experiment one time, finally, with relaxing. And we may find that we do have a kind of light support that's enough. And that something else happens. So on the weekend retreat, someone came, it was her first retreat, and she came to speak to me on the first and only full day, Saturday. And she seemed very well in her being. And she said, I'm really enjoying, I feel like a child and like a cat. And I've just spent sort of a few hours in a tree. She wasn't, it wasn't like for effect. It wasn't sort of, that kind of attention seeking. It was really by feeling what was helping her rest, what was restful for her. And the usual doubt comes that will come. Is that all? Am I wasting my time? Shouldn't I be focusing? Maybe I should sit up. Maybe I should try harder, etc. And I was, it was lucky for me because I could just point out to her, her own atmosphere around her of ease, connection, and that she could already start to sense and feel some other kind of, awareness, energy that was arising in the space that was left by relaxing. Being like a cat, the feeling was the way that cats rest so much, but also the way that their movement is alive and restful, easeful at the same time. So she was on that edge of maybe I should sit up and do some concentration practice for the rest of the retreat. And I said, yeah, whatever you want, whatever you think is good, but just notice now. And there's this possibility of another kind of movement that's not divided, another kind of awareness that's not contrived, it's not brought into being by my willful effort. I didn't make this awareness happen. I'm not keeping it up. It's coming with a totally different kind of trail. So I was happy when I saw her today. And she stayed with cat and child and felt complete with her two-day retreat, that she really got a real good impression of another kind of awareness that we don't have to make up, but that we can rest into, land into, discover, continually discover. Are there any questions or comments so far? Yeah, exactly. The next thing. Thank you. I want to give a most subtle and basic, we can say, example. And it's subtle, so let me know if we need to go into more detail about it. The most common shared pervasive way of that we can notice this pushing and pulling together is me watching myself. And this can come up strongly on retreat, in silence, in a group of people, where as I'm trying to come into my experience and feel what's going on and what is a thought and what is the body and what do my feet feel like, Are those feet down there? Etc. It's a kind of exposed experiment to really explore, to know that I don't know what I'm going to find in my own experience, and how easily I could feel, how could I have never noticed, how could I have never felt my foot before? After however many decades of life. And that's exactly the mode we keep falling into, and that somewhere we deeply wish to live into. A mode of discovery. A way of living that is exploring. That is not so focused on. It's not so directed. That we can end up going to extremes. Even with good intentions. So the main push-pull that would be almost everywhere is me watching myself. And me watching myself can sound like in my head, like you're watching me. So on the silent retreat, I remember this was one of the most important areas of discovery for me on the silent retreats I did. Ever so long ago. It wasn't like in the instructions on the board. So it's like, this feels really important, but this, I kept putting it to the side. I should just get over this. When I'm doing walking meditation and out of the corner of my eye see someone, I could feel a whole tension and reaction in response to that person in my body, in my mind. It's so important to have a chance to notice that, to feel it, to investigate it, to wonder about it, and to be able to feel also what isn't affected by that interpersonal story. I was, by the way, like a very good, obedient yogi. It wasn't that I even had eye contact. It was just out of the corner of my eye, I'm looking down. Earthquakes would happen. And so when I say that one of the main areas where we're pushing and pulling, where the pushing and pulling is happening to us, so to say, is me watching myself, we're also coming on retreat and we're really inviting that to come up. So don't feel like that's wrong when you notice there's me watching myself again. And then me watching myself in my head, oh, it's as if my mind says, oh, you're judging me, but it's actually my mind judging me. So there's different forms of me watching myself. Yeah? The mind all obsessed about what people think is quite normal. The mind could be also obsessed about what I think of them. And this is also another form of me watching myself, just projecting onto them. So one of the more important aspects of being on retreat is to have the chance to play. And it's easy when we are in silence together, and it's easy when we're each really getting in touch with our own inner resources and inner spaces, as well as hurts and gifts and our path. It's easy to feel that it's, because it's important, that it's serious. And this is again where you're going to end up like me on the ground with a dangerous play. Taking the ball too seriously without even realizing it. In total innocence of just playing fully. Taking the ball too seriously. It's just a game. We're playing. And the element of play can allow us to do a couple of important things. One is that when we do have the chance to discover the habitual contractions that happen, the reactions that happen in our psyche, in our energy, in our mind, in our body, this is a gift that we get to discover that. It doesn't feel good, but the discovery feels good. And so leaving room for that, how good the discovery feels, even if it's a discovery of yuck, a discovery of terrible insecurity, and you can't believe how much it affects almost everything you do, or terrible pride, and you can't believe how much it affects everything you do, etc. And those contractions, whatever name they may have, are not fun to feel, but the discovery of them is fun. So leaving room for that. That could be, if we don't take it so personally, like this is my insecurity that I've had all these years and I never even knew it, and we feel so embarrassed or ashamed. It's our insecurity. So when you discover it in yourself, know you're in good company. And that can help leave room for the of finding out, wow, this works like this. And that puts us in our power in a way. It's an empowerment that we can actually notice that this discovery happened. How does a discovery happen? We get things ready so that a discovery can happen. We can't make a discovery happen, but it does happen. It happens quite regularly when we stay with, but without forcing. When we have help, when we leave room for, and when we play. So there can be the discovery of the contraction, the habit energy, the difficulty, the delusion, the idea that had been putting all of your beautiful, wholehearted willingness to do whatever needs to be done into a direction that was too directed, that was too serious, that was too focused on winning or the ball or whatever. We notice those, and we remember that they're shared, and we enjoy the discovery, and we start to have access to, even though there is this habit energy or dynamic or contraction or pain, reaction from pain, even though that's there, there's also somewhere, somehow, something not affected, not even bothered. Sometimes it could feel like a sort of sense of humor, even. With. So when we're in life experience enough and life experience doesn't go how we planned enough, so like being in India happens obviously often, when the microphone isn't working, it can be endearing, it can be the sweetest thing of the retreat, that it brings out acts of love instead of like, come on, let's get to the Dharma talk. Focusing on what we thought was of utmost importance, that those words. And so with help, and with a team, and with coaching, that word is a little different now than it was 20 years ago, but let's say really metaphorically soccer coach, rather than all that it means now in professional title. Someone inside and outside who knows the game better than you do, and can see how your playing is going better than you do, has a wider perspective. And this is really wonderful to find out that you do have that in yourself. And the way to find out that we have it is to listen. There's a great story of the Buddha that I'll end with. There's the elephant driver's son who went to speak to the Buddha, listen to the Buddha, Gautam Buddha. And they had the usual hello and chit-chat and teaching on mindfulness. And the elephant driver's son, Pissa, said, yes, not only the monks, but we also who just live in the world, we also practice mindfulness just like that. And sometimes, he said, we sometimes practice from time to time. And somehow in the conversation, then Pesa mentioned, the elephant driver's son mentioned, that it was nice to see all these monks doing such great practice, and it was great to hear about how, what great attainments they had, and how for Pesa himself, it was difficult with people. He said he worked with animals. He said animals are open and humankind is tangled. Their body does one thing, their voice, their speech does one thing, their mind does another thing. But with the elephant, if I'm training the elephant and I go through town, the elephant will in every way possible and openly be tricky. We'll openly do every kind of trick on the way through town and back. Whereas with people, they're tangled, or he doesn't say we, but we're tangled. The body is doing one thing. The mind is doing another. The speech is doing another. With the elephant, it's just out in the open. And Gautama says, yes, yes, that's true. You're right. People are tangled and animals are open. And then Pissa says, okay, I gotta go now. Thanks. Bye. And Gautama says, okay, you may go at your convenience. And you can imagine already the Indian sideways nodding. You may go at your convenience. And then Pissa is gone, and Gautama says, it's too bad that Pissa left so soon, because he's wise. And if he would have stayed, it would have been good for him. Because he would have heard me say something about the four kinds of people. So they had talked about the four kinds of people: people who torment themselves, people who torment others, people who torment themselves and others, and people who don't torment anyone. Always very thorough. Sorry? Torment, torture, hurt. And so, of course, the monks say, oh, please tell us more about the people who hurt themselves, people who hurt others, people who hurt themselves and others, and people who don't hurt. And, of course, Gautam does. And it's very sweet how Gautam then goes on. And it's only by reading between the lines that you can understand why it would have been good if Pissa, the elephant driver's son, would have stayed. It's not a direct slap. So those who torture, when we torture ourselves, when we hurt ourselves, it's when he gives the examples of people who ate very little and did hard practice, basically. That was too hard. It wasn't beneficial. For us, hard on ourselves is the criticism and judgment and the kind of holding back from what's good for us, holding back from what we love. Those who hurt others, he gives the example, not using the word elephant, but those who are butchers, those who kill to sell the meat, and those who catch wild animals. He doesn't say elephants, though, but it's included in there. And then also he adds onto the list people who, the one whose job it is to kill the people, the executioner, people who run the prison, etc. So he puts it all together without saying elephant, but including the elephant driver's son in there. Because in India, they would have to catch, of course, the elephants from the wild and then tame them, so-called. And then he goes on. There are those who kill animals for sacrifice while also doing a hard spiritual practice on their own at the same time. Those are the ones who hurt both sides. And then he talks about people who are fully enlightened and give good teachings and do good practice, who don't harm anyone. So just that moment when Pissa has heard a little bit of teaching, and it's a couple, few pages of dense, repetitive story. And then he's like, okay, I gotta go. So that moment when we say, okay, I gotta go, and Gautam says, at your convenience. If we can stay with confidence, with where we know our wisdom comes out of in us, and keep staying, even when it doesn't seem to be directed at us or relevant to what's happening, so often it is. And similarly, in outer situations, it's often just after we left that it was really for us. It was what we were just now ready to hear. It wasn't going to be easy to hear. But we were just now prepared to hear that we could actually stop doing that job. Because we're ready to feel that that hurts animals. We're ready to hear that that hurts somebody who doesn't want to be hurt. Thank you. We can even ask ourselves, if we were giving advice to ourselves, what would we say? And listen, like not get up in the middle. And being ready for the discovery itself to be, wow, a change of perspective, a new way of playing the game is possible. That doesn't hurt anybody. Wow, it's possible. I thought we would just keep on losing and not making any goals and having fun. And the last thing that I want to emphasize in this, we may discover wonderful things as well as difficult things, keeping in mind also that the importance of just feeling what is it like when the discovery comes about. Discovery, small moments of, that's what it feels like, me watching myself, feeling self-conscious. Getting tight, thinking it's because they're judging me. That's all in my mind. Wow. That's just a movement of mind. And, I still have a back, I have feet. Wow. That's discovery. I don't mean only when the lights go out in your mind and you see suddenly like LSD or whatever. The spirit of play in silence, connecting inwardly to playing rather than outwardly to playing. Knowing that what we already know how to do hurts, mostly. We already mostly know how to be busy improving ourselves or the world and not being too satisfied mostly with how it goes. We already know how to, we're already good at, so to say, we have practice at focusing on the negative. And this we talked about a lot over the weekend. Some of you are still here. And so the new coach that can come in now, we've done that. Whether you've done retreat or not, you've done that. The new coach that can come in can now emphasize a completely different direction with what we don't know how to do, which is to practice feeling what's hard to feel, what's light, what feels like being at home, what feels like belonging, what feels like lightness, what feels like joy, what feels like nothing's wrong, what feels like, I'm useless. I have no occupation. There's nothing for me to do here. What feels like happiness for no reason. But it at first, mostly, will feel very hard to feel, very faint. And also a completely different quality. So it's not the quality of struggle that creates lots of memories that's easy to feel with lots of heat. It's more fresh, ungraspable, even unnameable sometimes, but simple, simple smile for no reason, simple lightness for no reason. So that's where now the new coach in us can start to be listened to more steadily, consistently, that even when things feel terrible, even if something's going wrong, and there's always some kind of wrong, doesn't need to be the object of our attention. We can still be attentive to not going for that's wrong, let's go for what's right, but just what's okay, what's here, what's fine, what's not freaked out. What's ready to play anyway? And we can start to feel a natural pull towards that subtlety and lightness, happiness.